Tonight's specific series, with the first of this series, is going to be speaking about what are our goals in chinuch, the parents' role, and the school's role. How do we deal with it? How do we deal with the challenges? Because we don't always think, a lot of our parents do not think like the yeshiva, and the yeshiva doesn't like thinking like parents, and that's because we're all human. How do we do that? How do we merge it? We have the tremendous schus to have with us the Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Aaron Lapiansky, who not only has an unbelievable depth and understanding of Torah, but he has a tremendous understanding of chinuch.
Let's give out this sheet. It's one sheet per person. Unless you pay double, in which you get two sheets, if you want like. But the focus of this will be a lot more on boys' chinuch. That's what I've been involved in most of my life. And high school boys, because, again, this is sort of the framework for it over here. And it has its own special needs and so on. But we divide into three parts. A lot of times, as a bystander, I would hear communications between parents and school and back and forth. And sometimes, I realize that people may not understand what a school can do, what a school should do, just don't quite get what the school can be used for, what it's effective at, what it's less effective, what's to be expected, and how. A lot of people, it is an extraordinarily broad community. People have very different backgrounds. Everyone is here sending their children to yeshiva because more or less the end product is what they would like. But what happens in yeshiva, what's normal, how it happens, and so on, for many people, they may have had very different experiences. They may never have had yeshiva experience. And I was trying a little bit to start with conversations I've heard where I feel there's a total lack of communication because people just don't understand each other, and build a framework around it. So this time, Mr. Shem was speaking about the broader sense of chinuch in the school. Sometime later, next time, we'll speak more about the academic aspect of the Judaics, obviously. So let's start off with a sentence that I found, or a complaint I always found amusing, if it wouldn't be so painful. Somebody becomes aware that a boy in yeshiva is doing something he shouldn't do. Smoking, drinking, graffiti, any one of the behaviors that you would expect somebody in yeshiva should not do. And the complaint starts, why can't you teach him that this is wrong? Why can't you teach them that's not appropriate? I would expect a school to teach, and so on. So let's take the word teach, the way its real definition is, and let's try to apply it. So ideally, teaching is, let's say, for algebra. So we present the problem, and then we show on the blackboard, this is how you make a formula out of the problem, this is how you solve the formula, this is the answer, this is how you plug the answer back. It's giving over information and techniques. That's the word teach in a very specific sense. And a school in its teaching, in its very literal sense, can do that, should do that, you know, depending on how well you do it and the aptitude of the students. That's the results you get. The idea that they were not supposed to paint graffiti, do we feel there was a lack of information? The poor child never knew that, and we had never bothered giving lesson behavior 103 about no graffiti on places where people in the community notice it. If you got to do it somewhere in the back of a building, not in the front. I mean, so it wasn't taught? Do we expect the rabbi to get up and say, okay, rabbi, say, let's go over clearly which behaviors are unacceptable. Do we actually feel that that's where the problem is? And so on. And when we ask ourselves, when we pick a person, when we pick a finished product of a Ben Torah, however your picture is, it includes an awful lot of things. Being a Yid, being a Mensch, a Yid, a Ben Torah, includes in itself things that you believe, things that you understand, basic behavior patterns, feelings of inspiration, etc., and specific areas of knowledge. So that whole areas, all those areas except for actually knowing Baba Kama, what does teach mean in that way? Do we expect someone to get up and say, Rabbeisai, this is unacceptable? Is it a one-time, very, very powerful speech? Is it the teacher once a week reminding the kids, once a day for slower kids? What does that exactly mean? How do we give that over? Punishments? So in terms of punishment reward, that's more or less a kind of a very mechanical behavior pattern. If you do X, punishment. If you do Y, reward. So we're sort of training the kids. Is that what we're doing? What exactly are we doing and how are we doing it? Also, as Rabbi Merkin mentioned, where does the home and the school interplay with this? Rav Huttner actually spoke about this Gemara. He spoke about it at a convention, at a Torah Masorah convention. I think it was one of the very few public conventions he attended. He disliked conventions and public gatherings with a passion, and for whatever reason he agreed. And he spoke sitting down because he's saying a shir, not a speech. He spoke about this Gemara, and he says, you know, everybody holds up this Gemara that we were the first to invent public school and, you know, school for everybody. And Yeshua ben Gamliel is held up as a hero. He said people don't realize, as Rabbi Merkin mentioned, that this is actually a poor substitute. This was sort of an emergency holding pattern. Because it should not be the school, but the parent. Why is that? So tuition is a good answer, but other than that, but I imagine if you'd have to stay home to teach your kids instead of working, I'm not sure that would be a better arrangement. So why is it that the parent's supposed to do it? It's not just an obligation, it's obvious that that's ideal, and Rav Huttner stressed that that's ideal, and when he finished in explaining it, he said, and my bracha to you, my dear teachers of Torah Masorah, is that you be out of a job next year, and that everything revert back to the old system. So what exactly is, why would a home be better? I mean, you know, parents are very nice people, and each one has their own skill set. One out of 10 parents is a teacher. So why would everybody be the one to teach their kids? You also have yeshivas. Yeshivas did exist in the times of Gemara. And the concept of a place, not everybody sitting home and studying, but a place, a hall of Talmidei Chacham did exist. So what is our chinuch founded upon and so on? So I want to start with the beginning. What do we believe? And how do we believe? So I'll start with Ramban. It's the second piece on the sheet, on the side that's full, obviously. The Ramban speaks about the mitzvah to remember and to keep in front of our eyes the standing at Har Sinai. That's the Ramban. So Ramban says, V'zeh sham Hashem gam b'chamin al-olam, if we bear in our memory a very sharp and crisp picture of Har Sinai, we will copy it, we'll give it over to our children. They'll know it's absolutely true. We will not give over false testimony to our children. We won't give them a legacy of nonsense. And they will never doubt the testimony we passed on to them. That's what Ramban says. It leaves us a little bit bewildered because every generation that rebelled against their parents, and our collective memory doesn't go back that far, 100, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, the Haskalah, reform movement, etc., all rebelled against parents and so on. So what does it mean that this becomes an absolute formula for preservation of it? So I think what the Ramban means is as follows. There is a concept that Rishonim bring in logic called muskolos Rishonos, which means axioms or first understandings. Where do we get our axioms from? So our mind works by layering the information we get. So a little toddler is beginning to grow up and wander around. So one source of information he gets is when he runs into a wall and it hurts. And that becomes by him very, very clear foundational type of idea. The second one is when his mother says, take the spoon. That this is a spoon is to him very elementary because it was brought in as the first layer. Don't eat with a fork. Soup you're supposed to eat with a spoon, not with a fork. So experience might teach it, and hearing it from his parents and so on. So a child builds up a certain amount of ideas that become the bottom layer of whatever it is they'll understand afterwards. If his parents speak about God as existing, that occupies the same level of fact as that this is a spoon and that walking into a wall hurts. Those are all the most primary understandings and ideas that are in their minds. I don't know what the cutoff for that is, but the young age is that, and the first source of information, not personal experience, are parents. So, yes, this is this, and so on, is all coming from the parents, and that's the first layer of cognition that a child has. Even the second layer, when a child is sent off to school, it's only because the parent says, oh, you're going to go to school. In school, they're going to teach you. What did the Rebbe say? What did the Mora say? What did the teacher say? It's because the parent is the most trusted one and his information is foundational that the child now includes what he picks up in school as a second layer. So the axioms of a child are all what the parents gave. At some point, you can rebel against it. We do have free choice. And in science, we've had ideas that were rock solid. Aristotelian physics was considered to be the foundation of the world until Newton came along, and then we realized a lot of mistakes in terms of, you know, astronomy. But you can uproot it, but it's very, very difficult. It requires a very intense cognitive directed effort to say to yourself, my bottommost beliefs are not true. It is one of the reasons, by the way, that when a child is in a position where he must reject his parent, it is the most destructive phenomena. Even if it has to be done, it leaves a terrible scar, because if that's not true and that's not real, so what is true and what is real? And this is what Ramban means. It's built into us that whatever basic instructions we have, so if our parents speak to us about Yiddishkeit as a child, and it's a given, this is the way it is. It's the same way that we say tomorrow the sun is going to rise at 6 o'clock and it rises at 6 o'clock and it has that same level of that's the way it is. That becomes our foundation for emuna. Once again, you can have bechira and think that people can reject. So that the parent does, and nobody but the parent. When you send a child to an institution, to a rebbe, to a yeshiva, it's only because you are sort of bestowing a sort of power of attorney, and you're saying, wow, he's going to teach you, they're going to teach you, and so on. The first fallout from this, I think, is important to understand, that the day that a parent expresses some sort of deep disaffection with a school in front of a child, his this part of getting these things from the school is over. If the parent mutters once about the teachers, a bunch of idiots, I assure you that nothing that the teachers will say in terms of what we're talking about, and we'll get to that in a minute, is going to stay with the child. And it's more than that. Let me explain what happens. So now the child says, okay, my parents do know everything. And they said that the teachers are idiots. So if I buy into it, I'm also an idiot. I'm one of those fools that my parents so wisely recognize as fools. So the child instinctively says, yeah, they're a bunch of nobodies. That's going to be the normal part of it. Or, once in a while at an older age, a child will rebel against his home, which is also tragic, like we said before. So if a parent is really dissatisfied with school, the right thing to do is to go to another school. No matter what, to keep a child in a system where the people giving him, and like we're speaking over here about, we're not talking about instructions, you know, where lessons or reading Hebrew or so. We're talking about the basic understandings of emes. Then the worst thing you can do is do that. I want to tell you over a story from Adam Gadol that I heard myself. Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz was my Rosh Yeshiva. He was a Gaon Olam. He was a brilliant Talmud Chacham. He was in Shanghai with the Meir Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Meir. And it was very difficult. You know, the Yeshiva was there. He ran the Yeshiva. He had one boy in Shanghai. His other children were born, his other two boys were born in Eretz Yisrael. His oldest son, Rabbi Fazl Chayim Avracha, who eventually became a very big Talmud Chacham in his own right. But that was his nachas, that was it. And he hired a melamed to teach Rabbi Fazl. Rabbi Fazl was 9, 10, I think he told me. I heard the story from Rabbi Fazl. The melamed was obviously not a very bright person, and Rabbi Fazl asked him a question. I remember even what the question is, and the Malamed answered an absurdity. Rabbi Fol was too young, but he saw his father's body language. It looked like his father was going to shoot off like a rocket. He looked, and he bit his lip and just pretended to go on. It didn't say anything. Rabbi Fol noticed it, and he didn't say anything. And the reason is, because he would have said something, so he would have had nothing. He would have his kids sitting with Adam Lamed. Even though it'd be worse, he'd be sitting with somebody who he's picked up that this man is not bright, this man doesn't know what he's talking about, and it would have destroyed him. So the most important, the connecting point is that. Let's give a different, I just want to, we need to understand this, how we work. When somebody says, we have a serious medical issue, we're going to see the best doctor. So-and-so. How do you know it's the best doctor? So, you know, so people try Googling and Yelping and all that. You know, it's very good for, I don't know, for which honeydew to buy. To buy a doctor, you want to do. So what do you do? I mean, so somebody who's foolish thinks that he's a medical expert. What you do is you go to the doctor that you trust, and you ask him. And the person will say, well, I don't know, but I'll ask somebody I know in the field. And then he gets back to you and he says, I spoke to somebody who's really big in the field, and he told me this person is absolutely amazing. So our connections are always layered. We start, this is a doctor I've used for 30 years. I know him inside out. He's been there through thick and thin. I have a tremendous amount of trust in him. And I build on top of that. Or there's somebody who was involved in medical referrals and widely respected by all, by the profession, and so on. So the same way the school is, like the Merck said, extension of the parents, the extension is the trust that you put in it. If you have a serious issue with the school, you need to bring it up with the school. You need to come and square and say, you know, the child's been taught this and this. This has been going on in classroom. This is bad. This is horrible. This is, I don't like it. That's fine. That's what it's supposed to be. But to have a child hear it once is enough to destroy any ability for him to get from the school. And that's, so the first thing that falls out from this, I think, is that the child's elementary point of trust is you, and the building of trust in the school is built on you. Two, how important and valuable is Talmud Torah? How important is that part of it? So part of it has to do with your own life. There is no substitute. A child's first sense of importance is the importance that parents ascribe to something. The school is only as important as the parent makes it out to be. I remember my father, Zechayne Vracha, himself had learned in yeshivas. He himself was a shamus in a very big shul. The Alstak shul was like this shul on Lori's side, hundreds of mispalim. And he was about tefillin, Yom Neiroim. When I turned bar mitzvah, and it was very special for me to hear him daven. He davened very beautifully, with a lot of depth and meaning. And I was, we were his nachas, we had two children were here, that was it. When we turned 13, he says, Kindelach, a bacha belongs in a yeshiva. And you need to go to the yeshiva. The yeshiva had a very nice minyan, and daven yeshiva. The word yeshiva minyan, from that point onwards, in my ear, has a very special ring. If he would have said, you know, it's a dragon yeshiva, then yeshiva davening would have automatically been placed in the drag bin, and sometimes you have to do it. But lamaisa, that's what it is. The amount of respect and chashivas that you give for studying Torah, the people who study Torah, and the place, and we're going to talk about that soon, a mokum Torah, directly will be what the child will pick up. If a child picks up that what you really respect is something else, then it's not going to help. I have a cousin who lives in the modern Orthodox community, and somebody decided for the bar mitzvah, their child, they're going to bring in five, I hope I'm getting it right, Nick players. There were five players from the New York area. Very chashev. They take $10,000 to come to make your simcha more Yiddishlach with their presence. And he brought in five. These are supposed to be very chashev players. I mean, I knew the Giants, the Knicks. I knew a bunch of the names, but I think it was the Knicks players. My cousin was incensed. He's a very idealistic person. He said, you know, they could have hired another teacher in the school for that money. So I told him, Ed, you're making a mistake. That's not the problem. There's enough money in our community to hire another dozen teachers with Nick players. That's not the problem. I said, would he dream of giving Rabbi Soloveitchik $10,000 to come to Bar Mitzvah? Maybe he paid for his Uber or taxi in those days. He wouldn't give a nickel to bring him. So it's very clear the scale of value. And no amount of no matter what the school's going to do, no matter how much the school will tell you that Torah is important, Talmud Chacham is important, Rav Soloveitchik is the God of Doran, is the most brilliant mind and the deepest person around, it's not going to help, because Kol Zein Eino Shavali, brilliant minds, big Talmid Chacham, pious people, occupy this place in the rung, in the hierarchy of importance, and somebody up there. That is, so the chashivus that we attribute to the place, If the word Beis Medrash carries in itself a sense of awe, of chashivas, the child picks up on it. If not, again, the child trusts a parent. And even when he's bickering with his parent, the things that he hasn't even noticed are automatically what the parents said or did and so on. So that takes us, that's the relationship from the parent to the school. How does the school impart those values? Is there an official shiur, like where Rebbe gets up and says, you have to believe, like catechism, you have to believe X, Y, and Z, and you have to act A, B, and C, and this is it. There is very little of that in a yeshiva. We'll speak more about it next time, Mitzvah Hashem, when we talk about the academics of the yeshiva. But there are shiurim here, there. It's spoken about occasionally, but it's not done in a It certainly doesn't occupy anywhere near the volume of how important it is to us. The things we mentioned, we would like them to believe the fundamental beliefs of Torah. We would like them to value the things that Torah values. We'd like them to be inspired. And we'd like them to know. But those first three things I mentioned are not easily given over in frontal teaching, in the specific idea of a lecture. And rarely does it work. It's not the way. So occasionally there could be a very, very inspiring speaker who come in once and inspire. It's not something that's the bread and the butter of any school. Where do you pick it up? So if you take a look at the next piece, there's a Rambam. The Rambam has a set of halachas called Hilchos Deos. Hilchos Deos refers to it refers to what we call Midos Tovos, which is strange, the Rambam's use of the word Deos. I would like to posit, I would like to use, offer my explanation for the word Deos. I would say Deos are basic attitudes and fundamental understandings. In other words, let's take anger, which Rambam speaks about, not over here, but previous parak. Anger includes an actual component of yelling and screaming, but anger includes a certain attitude. If he's disrespectful to me, I lash out at him. If something's not ready when I want it to be ready, the right thing to do, the social interaction is that I yell, I scream, I bang. There's a lot of fundamental attitudes that's really part of it. So the Rambam goes through the first few prakim explaining how to work personally on these attitudes. And then he says like this, Derech b'riyoso shel adam lios nimshach b'dei osov v'maisov achareya v'chaverov. A person tends to be drawn after his friends, and so on. Noheg keminhag anshe medinoso. And he acts like the people in his... The word Medina would be translated country. I want to translate Medina society. I think that's a much better translation for this. In other words, our set of interactive behavior is determined primarily by the society around us. We're geared to act like that. Normal people pick up very quickly the cues, and they understand how to act and interact. Normal people, by definition, want to be normal, and they don't want to stand out, they don't want to be different, and they take it for granted this is the interaction. So it is very hard, and I would say counter nature, to teach people as individuals. To expect people as individuals to act in a certain way. They need to act within the context of a society. And that's what the Rambam says, you need to move away from a society if you feel that the social norms and mores are not those that you want for yourself. So the Rambam here says that one of the greatest influences on a person, and it's not just an influence. We tend to think of ourselves as, let's say I'm a good person, and somebody comes up and says, no, if you join me, you know, and we'll do this illegal thing, and we'll get a lot of money, and so on. That's sort of seductive. That's like a Masism idea. Somebody's sort of seducing me through Navera. Here we're talking about, it is normal. The Rambam says, Derech b'riyoso shel adam. That's how we were created. It's not bad, it's how we were. And therefore, the vast majority of who we are, what we are, is formed by society. Now, this depends on different stages in life. So if, let's say, I as a grown-up go to visit Japan, I look at the country, I feel like a stranger, I have no sense of acting Japanese or like Japanese. It's not something that in any way, I'm past that stage. I am who I am, and you know, if I need for business to say a few words Japanese or to bear, whatever, I'll learn that. But my identity is frozen already, and I'm always be a ger v'toshav. I want to be a stranger in the midst of another country. A child is still forming himself. And the society around you is your self in this whole area of interactive behavior. And Rambam says this is normal. We're not, you know, why do you do what everybody else does? Because that's what I'm supposed to do. Yes, there comes a time when a person can stand against everyone. But the normal person is to be not like that. So if we ask ourselves, what is going to be the most profound influence on many of the intangibles of a child, it's the nature of the society that he's in. And a school, more than anything else, is a society. And I think that's very important to understand that. A school is a society. It has values. It has norms. And they're very nitty-gritty norms. If you do well on calculus, you get a medal. If you flunk the test, you have to sit all summer and take it over. If you do this, if you do that, some things are praiseworthy, some things are condemned, some things are condemned loudly, some things are unthinkable, and so on. The punishments and the rewards and all of that, it has a specific need. You need to be able to deal some discipline issues. But more than anything else, you set a system of what the society functions like. In other words, what is good, what is bad, what's unthinkable, what's obvious. All of those things are an intangible part and possibly the most important part in dealing with this area. So in terms of basic beliefs, basic values, it's going to come in through the atmosphere that a school creates. One, it means that a child is part of a society. It means if a person wants a child to be different, once it gets past a certain percentage point, it's not wise that the child be the lone ranger in a school. It's something that, let's say, Chabad Shluchim wrestle with all the time, and they have their own solutions. It's a very difficult situation. You cannot raise a child and say, well, everybody's like this, but you're different because you're better than everybody else. It's that doesn't work, and it builds a very, very distorted, a very troubled personality. Two, and this is another important factor, that a child feels that the rules and regulations in the school should be followed. It's not only for the functioning of a school. Going back to my Rebbe, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, who was an amazing person. He himself was an off-the-chart masmid, a learner. He was the type of person who could go for 3 days and three nights without sleeping. When I knew him, he was already not well, but in his younger years, the stories about him were astounding. His chinuch for his children, he insisted that they be part and parcel of the institutions that they're part of. Not to stand out. Not to stick out. And not to, if you want to learn lecture on the side with them, fine. But to create something which would be very different, that was unthinkable. And he inculcated it, and he would say it a pasuk, he would say shmuzin about it all the time, Besoch ami anochi yosheves. It's a pasuk, I don't want to go off on that tangent, that I'm together with everybody else. So the decision that the child, and therefore whether you hold, if let's say the yeshiva insists on black hats, so your choice is either to go to a different yeshiva, or that the child wear the black hat. Because a big part of it is being part of that environment, or whatever it is that the school insists. That is, when you find ways to get around rules and regulations, you can get special leeway for this, for that, either because you can pull some cards or whatever it is. You're doing yourself a terrible disfavor, because the child. It's two things. Either he feels he's not really part of everybody else, or the lesson he learns is that social norms are for the birds. The guys who are really mutzlachim know how to get around it and go. And I want to tell you a story that I heard about a woman I never zocher to know, but seeing her children and knowing and hearing the story, her name was Mrs. Zellinger, Zechayna Vracha. She was a woman in Brooklyn, a wealthy family. They were the big supporters of Kamenetz, Torah Samus Kamenetz. And they were very wealthy, and they were part of supporters of the school. And she had a son, Rabbi Yaakov Zellinger, just passed away. Him I knew well, just passed away recently. And he went to the school, Torah Samus. In those days, one of the patrons of that school was a wealthy man. I think I remember the name, but I'm not sure. He owned a big clothing factory somewhere in Manhattan. He had one of these old-fashioned clothing stores when they had manufacturing in Manhattan. And as a chesed for the boys in yeshiva, they would come down a week before Pesach, or 2 weeks before Pesach, and everybody would get a little suit with a shirt, with a pair of socks, with a tie to match, you know, like a whole little thing. And that was part of his stock, a chesed, etc. The boy, Rabbi Yaakov, this understood that he is not going through that ritual of being clothed as a poor yeshiva bacha. His mother came to the principal, and the principal told him, "You're excused." She said, "No way in the world. He's going with everybody else. I'll pay him. That's fine. I'll pay for the suits. Don't worry. It's not on the yeshiva's chesed, not on that person's chesed. But if everyone is standing on line for a pair of socks, he's also going to stand on line for a pair of socks." And maybe that's what Shazok said. I know two of the children, very wonderful, very special children. Because being part of that society, its norms, its values, you can move on later. But at the end of the day, that makes you a member of society. And therefore, the norms, the values, the ideas, whatever is intangible becomes part of it. So the two things we spoke about, the core values and the basic beliefs, are something that you pick up as being part of a society. And yeshiva creates society. It has to do with the bull session that a rebbe might have occasionally with the boys. It might be with boys talking to each other. It might be something spoken occasionally. It's not one specific speech. It's not one specific lecture. It is a general feel of a society that you're part of. When you feel you're part of that society, you take its values and it become yours. Again, I want to tell a story of a tremendously deep person, a person, a tremendously smart person. What it means to be part of a society. This person I'm telling over, his name was Rav Gadol Eisner. He was a Ger Chassid. He was before the war in Ger. And he helped rebuild Ger from the chinuch aspect. He was the mechanech of Ger in Israel, and he produced a generation of people that took on the values and ideas and ideals of Ger. He was an amazingly smart person, understood people tremendously. He was in Europe a few years after the war. There were still some Jews hanging around Poland, and they moved to France. You know, there was the shares of plate there. And one day, a former Talmud of his yeshiva in Poland came to him and said, "Rebbe, I got engaged." He said, "Very nice." He said, "It's not such good news. It's a Goya." So Reb Gadol thought a minute, and he said, "Listen, the halacha, I'm not sure yet. I have to look into the halacha really well. But for Chassidus Shabbacha, that's not the type of shidduch we expect a Chassidus Shabbacha to do." And he didn't do it. And he went on afterwards and so on. It makes no sense logically. I mean, if you're trying to ask yourself where the argument lies, no place. The answer is, as long as he emotionally connects him to Ger, then that's a society. He's a Gerer. And you find people who left the Derech and very sloppy, socially they'll still connect, and sometimes they'll come back via the social route, because this is who I am. I'm part of that. So understanding that the school, and therefore the child needs to feel part of that. And once again, if you're not comfortable, if you really, really uncomfortable with the society's part of, no matter how good A, B, or C, or D is, you really need to think seriously if it's not better to switch. It's part of. And the other hand, he needs to feel obligated. The idea that as society does, you go along because that's how it works, is an important key for societies to succeed. If I want to daven 7:03 in the morning, and everybody else wants to daven 7:15, and I'm not going to come to the minyan because it's just 12 minutes off from what I want to, you make somebody who's a misfit. So that's the second point over here. One more point. So we spoke a little bit about beliefs. We spoke about values. The third one is inspiration. We want our children to be emotionally connected to the Yiddishkeit. It's a tough one for a school. And I want to explain why. And this problem becomes compounded, because many people who came to Yiddishkeit late in life did it because they were inspired. They heard something, they saw something, they were very, very inspired, and then, you know, they move. So now that my kid has it at such an age, he should be singing, dancing every day. And he's not. He's grumbling and complaining every day. So, President, I don't get it. I guess my school, if we could only have, if my Rebbe could run the high school, we'd have them singing and dancing all day. It's not exactly how it would happen. It would be the same grumbling and complaining, I assure you. The problem is the nature of a school allows for limited ability for emotional inspiration. It's an academic institution. There's material that has to be covered. There are grades. There is a certain level of competitiveness. There is not really time for sitting down and having these type of sessions. So a school as such doesn't have the tools for it, really. What you do, you can create some tools, but they're not easy. For instance, a summer camp does a much better job than that. It's just the nature of that society is different. It's not around study. It's not competitive. It has camaraderie. It has free time. It's loose. It just has the right ingredients. We try to do, and we understand it, and we try to do it in yeshiva. It takes a tremendous amount to rebbeim get off only on Shabbos, and yet every third Shabbos, there's an in Shabbos in yeshiva. And the boys get a lot out of it. They get out of, first of all, it becomes a Torah society, B'nai Torah society. They see it's a difference when you have everyone together. There's a Dvar Torah, singing. There are rebbeim who can do it, occasionally in class, sit and sing with the boys. It's highly unusual. And you need to understand that a school struggles to supplement it. It also, children are at a certain age. Not every teenager is ripe for it. So it is a critical piece. But a school, just by the way a school is, has limited ability to do it. It's important to understand what your limitations are as well as what your assets are. So let's briefly review the points that we're making. Besides the academic piece, the things we want, I would list them at three things as becoming Torah Jews, Torah values, and so on. One is beliefs, certain fundamental beliefs. Two, certain values, what's good and what's bad. What's right, wrong, what's good, what's bad, and an emotional connection. The first one starts with parents. And if the parents honestly give the schools, like Rav Merkus said, the shlichus, they gave them the power of attorney, and it's understood, the child senses in the parent that this is what he wants for his child, so the beliefs and understandings that he picks up in the school become part of, they attach themselves to some very fundamental understandings that he has, and it becomes very fundamental to his system of belief. His values and understanding of what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad, who is to be commended and who's to be shunned and so on, that's picked up by his society. And the school creates a society much more than frontal teaching, as far as this goes. Frontal teaching helps guide it. When you point out why Yaakov Avinu is good and why Esav is bad, you do say it. But it's more that everyone buys into it, everybody feels like it. That's the environment. And the things that are unthinkable for a child to do, and the things that are sort of gray, and all of that goes into his value system. The school as a society is primary in doing that. But parents can undermine it if they don't. If they themselves feel that the school rules are just a game to get around, then the child, A, doesn't feel part of it, and he also learns that you get around things. That's what he picks up on. I once was shocked. There was a boy many years ago in the Yeshiva Gdola, a young boy, a lot of issues, not an easy boy. But finally, at some point, he actually moved forward and so on. And I was speaking with his father, who I knew just knew by face. We didn't live in the area here. And he said to me, so he was trying to get him into a star yeshiva or something, I don't remember, something of that nature. And he was getting pushback. He told me, you know, everything's a game. If you just know the price and who to connect to, you get what you want. So I understood the message. The child got that message as well. And I was stunned. I was taken aback. But then a lot of things made sense about why the child was always kind of figuring a way around things. But understanding, or again, you know, you need to pick a yeshiva that you feel this is the environment, and you need to be supportive of it. You may have reservations, and you may feel it's wrong, and you may be right that it's wrong. The place to bring it up is to sit down and speak with, whoever it is, Menahel, administrator, headmaster, Rebbe, whoever it might be, and talk about it, and that's fine. You can express yourself as strongly as you like. That's appropriate. But once you have that, so everyone always has a reason why once in a while you need to miss out on something. But when you put your schedule down as the beginning of everything, the end of everything, and the school is just a question of how to get around it, it's a roadblock we get around to, then in a certain sense you're undermining the central tool for having a child develop this way. It's also social development. Finally, the third piece is inspiration. And it is, in many yeshivas, it's lacking a lot. I don't know if a lot of them, we do in yeshiva here understand that it's significant. And that's why these inshabasim, for Rebbe, there's only day off is Shabbos. And every third Shabbos you're on duty again, and it's on duty full time, and the Shabbaton is 24 hours on duty and so on. It's a big Mesiras Nefesh. But everyone understands that those events provide moments of inspiration. Finding a good place in the summer, and Baruch Hashem, one of the wonderful things that came out of Yeshiva, I'm not plugging the camp, but the camp that three of our Talmidim have created and the staff coming, is a place where so much Ruach comes in. You can have a late night kumsitz with guitars and sing and stories. It's the right type of atmosphere for that. We try to do our best as we can. The Emir Tzashem, next time Emir Tzashem, I want to speak specific academic, because it's also quite different than what we're used to. It has its challenges, it has its difficulties. A lot of boys have a hard time getting into Gemara and so on. I'd like to talk about it. But until then, I try to give some sort of sense of the interplay, the fact that we're talking about two components that have to work hand in hand. The parent has to give the support, and this is much more than just agreeing. It's much more than lip service. He has to be on board and say, this environment is the important environment for my child, and I need to support it as such. And Be'ez Hashem, if everybody's on it together, Be'ez Hashem, we should have the Siyata Shemaya to do what we need to do.
Okay. Any questions?
Any questions? Yes?
Just to go back to the graffiti example. So in the case when there is a graffiti, and it's not the school to have to tell them it's not correct to do this,
part of the school needs to handle it in a way. There's the irritation factor. It's not fun to be sitting in the principal's office and getting 50 phone calls about, look what your students did. You would love to take the person who did it and, but how you react, you need to ask yourself, what's the statement I need to make? In other words, should I come down very harsh on it? Should I come down education? A big part of the reaction needs to be, in the big picture, how much significance do I attribute it, and how do I respond? So a teacher, mechanech, principal, etc., needs to make that decision based on what atmosphere does he create. And sometimes you may let some things go by because you don't want to have a very heavy atmosphere. Sometimes you need to tighten things, even small things, because the general feel has become loose and lax. It's part of the chachma of the person running the place to try to feel. But what you're trying to do is, it's a society making a statement. Let's take another example along the graffiti. Let's say everybody knows that the boy who did the graffiti is going through a very tough time at home, or whatever it is. He's having this. So students will pick up a message that even if you're down and hard and everything is bad for you, no one has rachmanis for you. On the other hand, if you let somebody get away with it, then you make a statement that drawing graffiti on somebody else's storefront is not a big deal. You're making a statement for the school as a society, and that's really what needs to go into the consideration about it. So that becomes, it's a difficult issue in, let's say, the school has somewhat different set of values. So let's take just a very extreme example, because it's not, let's say a type of Kiruv school where parents are not Shomer Shabbos, and in school you speak about Shomer Shabbos. It's a tough one, and it's not simple at all, you know. But I'm saying the main point is, whenever you take action that's kind of beyond the norm, you throw out a child, you expel a child, you do this, you do that, part of the consideration of the person taking the action is going to be, what statement does it give to everybody else? And everybody else should be first the students in the school. There's a lot of public pressure, and you know, I understand well how that plays out, and it's very hard to think just of the students, not think of public pressure. But ideally, my question should be, how bad do people perceive it, and what does my reaction say? You know, the kids may say, well, they were just fooling around, and just they got very hyper, and then somebody had accidentally a can of paint, and one guy was throwing the other guy, and then the valve got dislodged, and the paint got all. So when you come down hard, he doesn't get that message. That's really what should determine the reaction. And again, we're all humans. Sometimes reaction is just, I've had it. You know, that's also, everybody's a person. Okay, any other question, any other points? Yes? Rabbi Shnansky is a product of the yeshiva. Everything wonderful about him is because he's a product of the yeshiva. He's exhibit one, exhibit A. Yeah.
Only the good things.
Yes?
I find that as kids get older, I struggle with disease. You want to help them kind of build a filter for things that they're exposed to. Just different things, and not related specifically to school, but in general, what messages do they internalize? What messages do they say, you know, this is for me, this is not for me, in general? And when you take that in a school setting, so there's a lot of English teachers, there's Rabbeim. So let's take English teachers as an example. So your son could go home and say, wow, I heard, you know, someone made this, like, crazy comment. Could be a teacher, could be a student. And you talk about it, and you kind of help them. Okay, well, let's filter that. You know, that's something we belong into. That's something we don't. So how do you deal with that in a, you know, what happens in Judaic studies? You know, you have a Rebbe, you have a class, and, you know, every now and then people are human, but, like, maybe he says something that's wrong, but he comes home and he says, you know, the Rebbe or teacher, somebody said something that's just said this. And it's just registers being off by you. So obviously you don't want to say, like, oh, that's stupid and not. But the same way that you give over, that you filter everything else, would you say process it the same way? Like, well, how do you think about it? Does that make sense in terms of this? In the context, is it like never filter anything that comes out of the Jewish classes, or no, like everything else, you just have to filter it in a smart way.
So you can filter it in a way that you're explaining it in a different context. You can add your own little teretz, which you might feel is not actually what the Rebbe meant. And I'd say the Rebbe probably said it because of this, or he didn't finish the sentence. It's not quite, what he meant to say was this. You probably didn't hear it well, or he didn't get to the end of the story or the beginning of the story. You do have to dance around it. I'll tell you another story. A big person. I used to have like a small group together with Moshe Shapiro. We used to be together. And I came once. I was, I guess, the first, the second one were there. This is house was so was more Hamish, and he had a storybook on his table that stories from a storyteller who was very from. It's a very very from book. So I made some comment to him. I was Hamish enough. I said, "Oh, I see. There's this incredible depth must be in these stories that you must be if they finish." He was not amused. And he was very upset. And he said, "What should I do?" He said, "I'm beside myself. This book is nonsense. The stories are nonsense, and so on. My son got this as a prize from his principal for being a Mitzuyan. So I can't say anything. But it drives me crazy." And he said he wouldn't say anything, he was very worked up. But he wouldn't say anything. Reb Moshe was not sparing of words. He could cut things down to size. So you can say at best, you can say, Marshall, let's get an example. Again, I'm going to take an extreme example. Let's say you have a Chassidish Rebbe, and it tells you that if your child eats Knedlach on Pesach, it's like eating chametz. Which would be, in a Chassidish place, this is the way it would be given over. This is Yarek Val Yaver. It would also be elevated Yarek Val Yaver. So you need to explain to the child and say there are different shitas. By Hasidim, it is very strict, very important, and a Hasid who eats knedlach is on his way down bad time. We have a different shita, just like this in the Gemara. A child who's learning Gemara is exposed to machlokas all the time. Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel, Rav and Abaya, and you say it's a big machlokas, and they feel very strongly this way. Others feel very strong this way. It should take some imagination to live with that. To one of my children came home. He's a little boy. He's a third grade. He comes home very very happy. I asked him, Yaakov, why are you so happy? He said, "Because I have the best Rebbe Yerushalayim." I said, "Oh, that's amazing. How do you know?" He says, "He told us that we're fortunate to have the best Rebbe in Yerushalayim." So I patted him on his, and I said, "Yeah, you are very, very fortunate." fine. That was silly. So fine. But you learn to be diplomatic, and to figure out a way that the child, because if you keep going head and head, there's a problem. There's an issue there. Something should be done about it at the level. If it happened once, occasionally, that's normal. If there's a constant issue, then something that is, either your child is misplaced and the place doesn't belong, or the Rebbe is misplaced and the institution doesn't belong. One or the other, it shouldn't be coming up often enough to be a real crisis. Okay. Yes? You want this? Okay, fine. Okay.